Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter. Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Once upon a time in American department stores, they anchored the malls and shopping centers. Whether it was Saks Fifth Avenue, Macy's, Sears, or Kmart, there was a store for every income level. Changing shopping habits and an economy in flux have resulted in these stores going out of business, or at least winnowing down to a fraction of the footprint they once had. Locally, Value City Furniture has been holding going-out-of-business sales as they close their doors for good. The most recent news being the parent company of Saks Fifth Avenue, Neiman Marcus, and Bergdorf Goodman has filed for bankruptcy. We're talking about what the bankruptcy of Saks Fifth Avenue means for department stores and the retail industry. And joining us now is reporter Suzanne Kapner, who writes about the retail industry for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to All Sides, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me.
So Saks Global, that's the name of the parent company of several luxury brands of department stores, and they filed for bankruptcy. Does that mean that these stores, you know, the Saks Fifth Avenues and Neiman Marcus's, are going to go the way of Lord & Taylor? What's going on here? Are the Saks all going away?
No, as of right now, they're not going away, with the caveat that, you know, in bankruptcy, anything can really happen. But the plan is to restructure the company, get rid of debt, catch up on payments to suppliers, and emerge from bankruptcy with, you know, many of the Saks and Neiman Marcus stores intact. There will be some store closings, perhaps, for sure.
Yeah. So Columbus has a Saks Fifth Avenue in one of our malls. It's called Polaris Fashion Place. We also have a Saks Off Fifth, which is their discount store. How big of a footprint does this department store chain really have on the retail landscape? Are there Saks Fifth Avenues in most major cities?
There really are not. There's only, you know, a handful, about 30-something Saks, 30-something Neiman Marcus. You know, they tend to be in the bigger metropolitan areas, New York, LA, Dallas, in Florida. They certainly don't blanket the country. They're not like a Macy's, which is much more ubiquitous. But they are sort of among really the last luxury department stores, the last place a consumer can see all the luxury brands under one roof. And that does make them notable.
So I was reading about bankruptcies. I'm learning more and more about bankruptcies these days. And it's a way to get out of having to pay, you know, the full amount of debt that they owe and that kind of thing. But also, it's a way that these companies use to kind of close down stores. It's a good excuse if they have stores that maybe are not performing well. Can you talk about that?
Sure. There are some overlapping stores. There are malls where you have both a Saks and a Neiman Marcus. And when they merged these two retailers, they couldn't necessarily close all the stores they wanted because there are leases and those leases have terms and you can't just break them. But in bankruptcy, there is more leeway to do that. So we should expect there will be some store closures. But also, I've been told by real estate executives that even if they operate in the same mall or same city, in some cases, both the Saks and the Neiman are profitable. So you may not want to close them down if they're both earning money. But still, there will be definitely a paring back of the retail footprint.
And I learned Saks Global, I don't even know if I realized that they own Saks Fifth Avenue, Neiman Marcus, and then the one I struggled to say, Bergdorf Goodman. Is this common for companies to acquire their competitors like this?
Well, it certainly has happened over the years. Look at Macy's. They have rolled up, you know, all the local chains from Marshall Field's, you know, throughout the country to create one ubiquitous Macy's. In this case, they kept the distinct brand names intact. But yes, it does certainly happen. And the thinking is that you could, you know, you combine Saks and Neiman Marcus, you can take a lot of costs out of the back end and save some money. And then you create a company that has more leverage with suppliers, because some of these suppliers, you know, Louis Vuitton, which is owned by LVMH, and Gucci, which is owned by Kering, these suppliers have grown so huge that they really have all the power today. So there was a good rationale for bringing these companies together.
Sears once used the tagline, "Where America Shops." So today, now you'd be hard-pressed to find a Sears, right? And stores like Sears and Kmart, if they can't make it, how have these luxury stores remained opened? How are they making it?
Well, they're struggling, clearly. You know, the world has changed, and the brands have opened their own stores, and they're competing directly with these department stores. And then you have the internet, where you can go and find all the brands. You know, there are still people who want to go into a physical store and see a whole display of different brands under one roof. But the market is shrinking, and they've been struggling, and they're trying to hold on. But, you know, there are powerful forces against them, making it very difficult.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what the bankruptcy of Saks Fifth Avenue means for department stores and the resale industry with Wall Street Journal reporter Suzanne Kapner. So if you go into a Saks Fifth Avenue store, you can buy Gucci, Prada, Burberry. There's lots of high-end brand names in there. But these designers all have standalone stores as well. So is that a part of the problem for these department stores? Like, you can get your Gucci bag at a Gucci store, or you can get it at Saks Fifth Avenue?
It is, because, you know, that there's just much more competition, and there are consumers who are going to want to go to that Gucci store, and you're going to get, you know, very special treatment if you're a good Gucci customer that you might not get at a department store. Moreover, the brands are changing the terms. So in the past, it was what they call a wholesale model, where Saks would buy goods from Gucci, mark it up quite a bit, and then sell those goods to their customers. Now the brands want more control. So Saks is really becoming almost like a landlord. Gucci will rent space from Saks. They'll have their shop in a Saks store. They staff it with their own employees. They own the merchandise. They control the customer connection. It's a much less profitable business model for the department store. So that's also hurt their business.
I'm sure Gucci likes that better, though, right?
Yes.
So in the introduction, we cited changing shopping habits and the economy, both as reasons that this is happening. As someone who covers the retail industry like you do, what do you think is the main reason that Saks Global filed bankruptcy?
Well, the main reason is that they fell behind on payments to creditors, to their suppliers. So if you're not paying your suppliers, they're not going to ship you goods. Then you don't have enough stuff to sell. And then you are earning even less money. You have less money to pay suppliers. You end up in this downward cycle that is very hard to get out of, on top of the fact they took on a lot of debt to do this deal. So that was just a recipe for disaster. That is specific to this company, but, you know, there are forces out there that are changing the way consumers shop. You know, department stores have been in decline for decades, you know, with the rise of discount stores like Walmart and Target, with Amazon, you know, which has made a big push into having luxury items on its own website, and in fact has a joint venture with Saks that is now potentially in jeopardy because of this bankruptcy. But you see, look at the retailers who are doing well. TJ Maxx is on fire. I can't remember the last time they had a down quarter. And they offer value. Consumers, especially in this environment, want value. So you can still, you know, if you're willing to dig through the racks, you can find that, you know, maybe that designer item at a big discount. And that is very appealing to a wide swath of customers.
I'm sure that some of the people who are owed money want to blame someone. So they might blame the executive chairman, Richard Baker, the Saks Global, the guy in charge of everything. Is it his fault?
Well, he has certainly been painted the villain. And, you know, you could say the buck stops with him. But I've been writing about this industry for a long time. I covered the Sears bankruptcy. And, you know, we've seen these financial players. In this case, Richard is a real estate guy. But, you know, people who don't have retail backgrounds come in and think they can, you know, they know better and they can do it better. I will say, Richard's intentions were good. He put a lot of money into the stores, into renovating them. I truly think he wanted to run a successful retail business. He wasn't just buying it to strip it of its assets like we've seen some other financial buyers do. But, you know, the strategy, you know, just was, there were flaws. It was not executed well. There were, you know, distractions that took management's time away from just the nuts and bolts of running a retailer. And there was the debt, which was, you know, for a retail business, having too much debt is a real problem because retail sales go up and down. You know, we've been in a luxury slump now since the pandemic ended. You saw LVMH the other day had sales were, declined, especially in their fashion business. So, you know, you have these macro challenges. And when you have too much debt, you just paint yourself into a difficult corner.
Yeah. And you mentioned that the chairman, Baker, he's a real estate guy. I mean, to try to get out of this debt, he was trying to save the thing. And he even sold the land underneath Neiman Marcus in Beverly Hills, which got him a lot of money, but not enough.
Not enough. He was trying to sell Bergdorf Goodman, which, you know, is probably, you know, the pinnacle of luxury department store shopping in this country. It only has two stores, both in New York City on Fifth Avenue. And it's very famous for having a very exclusive and wealthy clientele. And he was shopping that around, trying to find a buyer for, you know, about almost half of the, you know, of the business. And he just ran out of time.
You mentioned TJ Maxx, and I also think of Target and to some extent Kohl's. Those come to mind as stores that are still in business and they advertise regularly online. You see TV ads all the time. But in some of the comments on your recent story that you wrote about the Saks bankruptcy, there was a common sentiment, and I'm going to read one of the comments. It said, "You only need to look around to understand why these stores are going out of business. Very few people dress well anymore and instead just opt for that roll out of bed look." So what's your assessment of comments like that? Is that why this is not working, because of the roll out of bed look?
I do think there are still plenty of people who go to, you know, society functions. They go to fashion shows. The fashion world is thriving. You could see at the fashion shows in Europe. I mean, you know, it's not like the rows are bare. I mean, people, there is a slice of people who really want the latest fashions and have the money to pay for them. So I'm not entirely sure that that is the reason. You know, plus at these stores, you can also buy very casual clothes, but, you know, expensive, like cashmere, you know, lounge suits to, you know, sit around your house.
The fanciest leggings I've ever owned. Yes.
Right, right. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know that that is, you know, the core reason.
Okay. And you wrote that Nordstrom and Bloomingdale's is doing okay-ish, right? Like they're rivals. They're doing well.
Yeah, they're doing quite well. I mean, Bloomingdale's sales rose more than 8% in the last quarter, which is a big gain for a department store. And they've been pushing more and more into the luxury space. I think both Bloomingdale's and Nordstrom have been benefiting from those, you know, Saks and Neiman's problems. So there is a customer out there with an appetite for, you know, expensive luxury goods.
Okay, so if they make it out of bankruptcy and keep some stores opened, what do you think they're going to do to survive for more than just a couple of years?
I mean, first they've got to get current with their suppliers and mend those fences. You know, Saks did a lot of damage with its suppliers. They don't trust Saks. Some of them have stopped shipping and may not decide to ship going forward. So, I mean, that's job number one. And the new CEO who had previously run Neiman Marcus before he sold it to Richard, he's been in the luxury industry a long time. You know, he's a good person to, you know, steer this through. And so that's job one. And then they just need to, you know, they always say retail is detail. And it is the little things, making sure you have the right product, the right, you know, the service that somebody would expect from a store like a Saks or a Neiman Marcus, having enough salespeople on the floor, you know, just like little things that make people want to come into the store, whether it's, you know, the nice restaurant or the, you know, private stylist or, you know, a shopping club, you know, that's a little bit exclusive. I think you've seen players like My Teresa, which is online only, so it's not quite comparative. but they do a lot of special events for their customers. They will have lunches or dinners at, you know, Dolce & Gabbana's home in Italy to make people feel like you're part of this club and you're really special, and it makes people want to shop there. I think Saks and Neiman need to do a little bit more of that.
And just to end on, I mean, one thing, when you come out of bankruptcy, it's a way where you don't have to pay the full debt you owe. You pay like a fraction of it. So you wrote in your piece that Chanel is owed $136 million. The company behind Gucci is owed $60 million. Even if they come out of bankruptcy, if Chanel only gets a fraction of its $136 million back, would you be surprised if we don't see Chanel in Saks Fifth Avenue?
Well, there's something called, I think it's called a critical list of creditors. Saks is going to prioritize paying the vendors that it needs. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing Chanel is top of that list, and Louis Vuitton, and it needs those brands to survive. So it is going to do everything in its power to make sure it makes those brands whole.
Okay. So the smaller brands, not the, I want to call them mom and pop, but they're mom and pop luxury places, they might not get their money back.
The smaller brands will be at the back of the line. But don't forget, these are just the unsecured creditors. There are also, you know, the secured creditors, the debtors have taken over the company. And, you know, so there's other debt outside of what they owe the vendors.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens. But we've been speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Suzanne Kapner. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the liquidation of Columbus-based retailer Value City Furniture. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
The United States once saw part of its mission as a nation builder, peacekeeper, and defender of democracy. The Trump administration, however, plans to exit from more than 60 international organizations. Once considered the arsenal of democracy and the leader of the free world, we're talking about how this withdrawal from international organizations is changing the United States' image on the world stage. That's tomorrow on All Sides with Amy Jurevich from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. In 2024, the Columbus-based discount closeout store, Big Lots, closed its doors. Now another Columbus-based retailer is facing the same fate. Value City Furniture, after failing to attract a buyer, is facing liquidation. Columbus Business First reporter Dan Eaton has been covering Value City Furniture and its closings, and he joins us now. Welcome back to All Sides, Dan.
Good to see you, Amy.
So Value City Furniture, the company, has officially been around for 77 years, but it's actually been over a century of being owned by the Schottenstein family. Can you tell us the history of the company a little bit?
Yeah. It actually started, you know, the Schottenstein family had department stores here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, furniture sales started as part of the department store. Mm-hmm. So, and eventually the business grew up to a point where they spun it off into, you know, its own entity. I think that was about the 1940s or so. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know it as Value City here. It's sort of funny, you know, from a legal standpoint, it's actually called American Signature, which was the name they brought on in the 90s. And there are other markets where, you know, it's the same store, but it's known as American Signature. But here it'll always be Value City because that's the name all of us grew up seeing on stores around town.
Yeah. Okay. So I was going to ask you about that American Signature. Mm-hmm. Is it because I live here that I was like, oh, wait, what's American Signature?
Yes. Yeah. That's okay. Exactly it. Yeah. Same company. So, you know, if you look at some other coverage nationwide, you know, other markets will refer to it as American Signature. And technically in the documents, it's American Signature. That is the name of the mm-hmm. company. But, you know, they still operated here as Value City. And a lot of their Midwest footprint was still Value City, which is that's the name that people knew it as.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, from commercials and from,
it's like a Checkers Rallies is the example I always use. You know, some markets have a Checkers restaurant. Some markets have a Rallies restaurant.
I didn't even know those are the same thing. Yep. Wow. Look at learning new things every day with you, Dan. Okay. So at the time of closing, which is now, how many Value City Furniture stores were still in operation?
Yeah, there's about 89 today. I counted them up this morning, as of this morning on their website. So there's 89. They've closed about 20 or so. Because some of these closings actually started before they filed for bankruptcy. Mm. So they were already in the process of closing some locations in Michigan and Nashville in particular. But it looks like they've gotten rid of about 20 to 30 stores so far, with another 89 to go.
Okay. And then you called it a regional chain. Was it national or was it just?
They were in, I want to say, 17, 20 states, something mm-hmm. like that. But largely Midwest, down into the South, I think a little into, kind of the Atlantic. Atlantic area, but they weren't out, unlike Big Lots. Big Lots was fully, nationwide, but Value City doesn't have a presence, out in California, places like that.
So. Okay. So how many jobs are we talking here? 89 mm-hmm. stores. There were, I think, 5 in Columbus.
Yeah. Company-wide, I mean, that's thousands of jobs. Here locally, the headquarters, which I believe officially shut down last week, you're looking at about 250. I think it was, they reported 300 plus as sort of headquarters employees, but a chunk of those were remote. I believe about 250 or so of those were based here in Columbus.
Okay. So, and then thousands of just like the retail store employees, people selling the furniture on the floor.
So obviously a lot, there are still employees working because these stores are still open, but, mm-hmm. That's going to go away at some point.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the liquidation of Columbus-based retailer Value City Furniture with Columbus Business First reporter Dan Eaton. So what about all these buildings? Mm-hmm. For not just there's the headquarters building, that's one, but the furniture stores are huge. I mean, they're big buildings. Now, will they all sit empty?
If we look at Big Lots as an example, I think Big Lots are probably a little smaller than a Value City, so it may be a different proposition for Value City. But, a lot of the Big Lots real estate has been snatched up here in the past year. There aren't too many that are still sitting vacant. In that case, you saw some similar sort of discount stores or thrift stores, move into those spaces. I don't know if you're going to see those buyers for the Value City spots. Value City also has some pretty prominent, they're up at Polaris, they're at kind of Sawmill in Dublin Grayville Road mm-hmm. there in Dublin, with some good co-tenants that are still pretty busy. So I'd imagine it would be attractive real estate, but they are big spaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As someone who reports for Columbus Business First, and your business is businesses mm-hmm. here in Columbus, were you surprised when you found out that Value City Furniture, with a family, the mm-hmm. Schottenstein name behind it, that they were going bankrupt?
No, not totally. That's more of a reflection of what's happened with furniture. They're experiencing the same, a lot of the same things that hurt Big Lots, which was during COVID, furniture retailers saw this massive boom in sales in 2020 and 2021 because people were home. Some people say because of the stimulus checks, people got money and they were reinvesting in their homes, buying new furniture. And then since then, everybody quit buying furniture because, because they either stocked up or remodeled then, or you also have just the economy today, right? Mm-hmm. People wouldn't maybe be buying these big ticket items anyway because of some other factors, interest rates and rising prices because of tariffs and things along those lines. But that has hit furniture retailers nationwide, mm-hmm. In all of them. There are very few that that are growing sales. And this is a several year trend. So it wasn't totally shocking because furniture has been a very tough place to be in retail in the last, 4 years or so.
But in defense of furniture, mm-hmm. I would be hard pressed to buy a couch on Amazon without sitting on it.
Sure.
Right? So there's that.
you say that, but
But people do.
I was going to say there's Wayfair in Wayfair.
Wayfair. Okay.
They're online and they have actually also had several years of struggles, but they seem to have kind of turned business around in the last year. They're growing sales again, and they're actually building a brick and mortar store in Columbus. So that is a furniture retailer that is expanding to Columbus.
Where is that going to be?
Up in the Polaris area. They're going into, there was a furniture retailer called Art Van Furniture that went out of business several years ago.
And someone finally bought that building?
Yeah.
It's been sitting empty so long.
It has been. And Wayfair will be going into that space. And then, you know, there'll be a Value City opening up just a few doors down because the Value City's right in that area as well.
The Value City spot will be empty.
The Value City spot,
I was
sorry. Yes, no, good.
I'm like,
good,
whoa.
Good clarify.
Value City spot will be empty, so it'll sit empty the way that Art Van store sat empty. Every time I drive to Polaris, I'm like, oh, look at that big, giant, beautiful building with all those windows.
It's a big building.
Okay, so let's talk about other impacts of Value City furniture closing, because the brand name is kind of ingrained in Columbus, right? I mean, so much so that there's Value City Arena here on Ohio State's campus. Value City Arena is inside the Schottenstein Center. So what's going to happen with Value City Arena?
The Value City name is already going away. I've been told by Ohio State it's still the Schottenstein Arena, but they have been, since the bankruptcy filing, I've been told that OSU has been taking the Value City name down or off of things, be it, you know, the court or wherever it was displayed, signage, things like that. So Value City name is definitely going away, is in the process of being taken away.
So talk to me about the Schottenstein name then. Mm-hmm. Is it, are the Schottensteins okay without Value City?
Well, I mean, I think so, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, they own and run DSW. They have that business, and there's multiple components to that. You know, Jay Schottenstein is the CEO and chairman of American Eagle, which is not based here, but American Eagle is a very successful retail brand that the Schottenstein family, you know, has an involvement in. They're partners in a retail liquidation business that is very busy, including doing the liquidation of the Value City stores.
So they're doing their own liquidation?
They are. And actually the entity that's buying, it's a Schottenstein's own entity that is actually purchasing Value City, and then they've hired a company that is partially owned by the Schottensteins to liquidate it. So, you know, the family seems like they're doing fine in this case.
I don't understand. I need a bankruptcy attorney here. There's money to be made in bankruptcy.
Yeah. There was some entities that raised objections to that they would be selling essentially to a family owned, selling their family owned business to another family owned business and then having another family owned business liquidate it. The judge, you know, has consistently ruled that everything looks to be above board. There are, you know, behind the scenes stuff. They have independent people and committees that are like coming up with these deals. So I think that's why the judge is like, this is all okay. But it just goes to show you the reach and the breadth of businesses that the Schottensteins are involved in. So I think they'll be fine.
Okay. So the Schottenstein Center will be remain named.
There's no indication that is going to change. So.
Some Value City furniture customers have had problems getting refunds on purchases, I saw some posts about them ordering something and getting the wrong furniture. Is this being rectified before they close, or is it just kind of like you're out of luck?
It is. They are directing everybody to file claims through the bankruptcy proceedings. So it will be in the hand of the court essentially to determine how those things are resolved.
And I was also just learning from our previous guest talking about Saks Fifth Avenue's bankruptcy. And there's a lot more money involved there, but it's they owe debt to a bunch of companies. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming Value City Furniture is the same way. They have bought furniture. Their stores are stocked with furniture and they owe money they owe too much money. That's basically why they're going bankrupt.
Yeah,
right?
That's usually the trigger in the decision. And you know, because you owe vendors, you owe banks, you owe real estate, you owe your employees, who unfortunately often are a little further down the line in terms of priority. You owe customers, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you've committed to give them something, you know, they are owed a good or a refund here as well. But you know, with a bankruptcy, there's just a tiering, there's a system to this, and some people are rated higher than others, and they get the priority claims on whatever money is there at the end.
Both Joann Fabrics and Big Lots, they're both Ohio based retailers. They've both gone out of business in the past couple of years. Is there anything you can tell us about, you know, what's been going on? You mentioned that businesses are buying some of the empty big lot stores. Mm-hmm. What about Joann's big?
I think you're seeing the same. I don't know an exact example offhand, but you know, these are often in decent enough areas to attract new tenants. You know, sometimes that's temporary. You know, it's a spirit Halloween, you know, things like that.
Oh, I see.
But,
yeah.
But you know, there are buyers out there. They're expanding brands. We saw with you know, there's another furniture brand out of town called Bob's Discount Furniture. They're one of the brands that's actually doing well in the current markets, and they've come into the market. They actually took an old big lots. They found a unit down in Pickerington as well. I can't remember offhand what that was. It wasn't a big lots or a Joann's, but you know, there are boxy retailers that are still looking for space out there.
Yeah. Well, and to out myself as being wrong, as you were talking, I realized that I did buy a couch online without sitting on it, right? Because I needed a specific shape for my house,
sure.
And I wouldn't be able to get one up the stairs unless it came in pieces. And so this one particular company, whose name I can't remember, sells couches in pieces and you put it together. And that's what I needed for my space. So I did buy it without business now.
So who knows?
I know. I don't even remember the name.
Yeah.
I just, you need what you want at the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So we have a few minutes left. Mm-hmm. When I have you here to talk about business, I like to ask you, is there anything else that you're working on or looking at? Like, how's Columbus doing? What's going on?
You know, I think Columbus is doing all right. You know, it's the classic, you know, we're somewhat insulated from bigger economic issues due to, you know, sort of the stability of having government here, having Ohio State, things like that. So I think we're doing all right. January is it's a tough time to ask that question, especially for someone who predominantly covers restaurants, because it's an awful month for restaurants, you know, restaurants and bars and breweries. It's
snow doesn't help or anything.
snow really doesn't help. You know, I was actually talking, it was interesting. I was talking to a restaurant yesterday for a future story, and one of the things they brought up was how not just losing 2 days because of snow, but because of OSU not going as far in the playoff. It was a pizza place I was talking to, and you know, last year Ohio State won the national championship, which meant there were a couple extra nights of people ordering pizzas, right, and having people over their house to watch the game. And now they're going to look at this year's numbers and this year's January, and it's going to be down because they lost two huge days just because Ohio State didn't have a couple extra games that it had the year before. So there's a local specific economic tip for you, as businesses that get a big boom off of Ohio State are definitely down here in January.
Do you feel like since Value City Furniture seems so ingrained as like a Columbus business, the same way even Big Lots was ours, you know, and now it's gone.
Sure.
Is that going to impact people or Columbus or will it just fade from memory?
You know what? I don't know. I am old enough that I think about things that way, and I think it would, but I just kind of wonder if younger people, you know, do they even know Value City is based here, right? Is there any association with Value City or with Big Lots? You know, the Schottensteins are obviously an important, meaningful name here in town. And as someone both of my age and in my profession, that's very prominent. But does that resonate with with younger generations? Like, do these brands matter to them? I don't know. That could be. Maybe the answer is because they are going out of business, and they're telling us that these brands are not meaningful, right? Maybe the proof is right there.
Maybe the proof is right there. Yeah, and I guess it's just whether you shop there or not. Mm-hmm. Like, so if you always bought your furniture from Value City and you have a connection with them, then that's the thing. But because I'm trying to think of the name is escaping me. The taco chain where they closed all of them.
Just the recent one?
Yeah.
The Torchies?
Torchies.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was reaching for that example because, you know, I have someone in my life who loved them and is like, now they're all gone.
Yeah.
So they care, but. Yeah.
Well, and it's funny, Torchies is actually kind of an interesting example because they started in Austin as a food truck, and they have, if you know people from Austin or from Texas, like that's a very resonant brand there. It's a very important, meaningful chain to them, but there's no meaning in Columbus, Ohio for them. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, they even talked about the decision, but you don't close, you know, it's rare to close a restaurant that's doing well. I'm sure their sales were not what they wanted it to be. I think that's safe to assume, but you know, that's a brand that doesn't mean anything in Columbus, and it's hard when you get far away from your roots like that to to continue to resonate in the way that maybe you originally did with your strongest fans.
All right. Well, my family member will find tacos elsewhere, right?
There are plenty of options.
There are plenty of options. We have been speaking with Columbus Business First reporter Dan Eaton. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, the retail analytic perspective on the changing ways customers are shopping. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. The bankruptcy filing and store closures of Columbus-based Value City Furniture and the parent company of Saks Fifth Avenue call attention to the troubled state of retail and department stores. We're talking this hour about the past, present, and future of department stores and retail shopping. Joining us now is Brandon Speck, National Director of the U.S. Retail Analytics CoStar Group. Brandon, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
So whether it's a department store chain or a restaurant chain, what is your data telling you about the state of retail and restaurants here in America? How are we doing?
So surprisingly, while the headlines are seemingly negative, I would say we're in an actually pretty balanced environment right now, Amy. We're seeing contractions, certainly as we see certain brands cut floor plates, as we see certain brands go out of business. But that spending still finds its way to new retailers. And so while we're seeing contraction on one end, we're seeing a lot of expansion on the other. And the two are meeting each other pretty head on.
Are there always these, stores going out of business for like decades, but it just seems like a lot now, maybe because we're hearing about it in the news more and more?
I think that's absolutely the case. So retail lives in a constant state of transition. Mm-hmm. We're always cutting brands that weren't working. The consumer is always kind of shifting their focus towards new brands. So where some are failing, others are rising. And I'd say that's definitely been a consistent trend for the better part of three decades.
Mm-hmm. According to your data, what factors are having the biggest impact on where, how and where consumers are spending their money?
Absolutely. So I would say first and foremost is consumer choice, and that is consumers have more choice now than ever. So we're seeing a lot of that shopping that used to happen in the brick and mortar channel migrate its way online. So when we think about certain soft goods, when we think about apparel and footwear, a lot of that spending has now found itself through the e-commerce channels. But in the same respects, we're seeing consumers still want to be out shopping, socializing in a physical environment. So there's been a lot more focus on entertainment, on restaurants, on socialization, and a lot less focus on apparel, footwear, and some of those more traditional retailers that used to tenant shopping centers across America.
So are you saying that people will leave their house for an experience more so than they'll leave their house for a shopping destination?
Or in some respects, the shopping destination can become the experience, but it has to happen in a pretty seamless way. So while I'm out perusing windows and looking at goods, I'm also grabbing a bite to eat and potentially socializing with friends. So what used to be a much more trip-oriented experience, I would say, is a much more social experience when it comes to the shopper.
Earlier in the show, we were talking with a Wall Street Journal reporter who's reporting on the bankruptcy of Saks Fifth Avenue. And she was saying that she thinks they'll make it out of this and be around for years to come if they make it more of an experience. She was describing going in and, you know, trying on clothes and then having lunch, like, and it being a nice big experience. But at the same time, in that same interview, she said that TJ Maxx is doing great and doing fine. And that's so it's very I mean, those are just widely different opinions. Right. So how can both be doing great?
Well, I think it's a widely different consumer. And I think that that is the key. We've heard a lot about the K-shaped economy, the K-shaped consumer environment, where the wealthy, the affluent, the professional class are doing very well, spending more than ever. But a vast majority of your American households are struggling under the weight of inflation, under what are seemingly never-ending increases in necessities. And that's pushing those individuals more towards a TJ Maxx, more towards a Dollar Tree. So when we look at who's doing well, it really is a dichotomy by who is your consumer. And it's the middle market that's really struggling. So the top end, the luxury retailer is generally doing well. Discount, off price, serving kind of the mass of American households are doing well. It's really that middle retailer that's struggling in this environment.
Okay, yeah, because even though they call it here, Value City Furniture is going out of business, even though they called themselves Value City Furniture, they weren't necessarily like super cheap. You know, it was kind of in the middle. Can we back up, though? You called it a K-shape economy. What does that mean? Are you talking about the letter K?
The letter K, yes, absolutely. So many are using the letter K to describe the trajectory of the affluent versus the rest of the households in America. And so we can think about that upper leg of the K pointing up, and that describes the spending patterns and the overall wealth patterns of the highest 20% paid Americans. When we think about the lower leg of the K, that's generally, unfortunately, been everybody else who's struggling under the weight of higher housing, higher healthcare, higher education costs. And that's leaving them to really try and make their dollars stretch as far as possible when they do go out and shop. So that's pushing demand into a TJ Maxx or into a Dollar Tree versus a Macy's or a Saks.
What are the people in the middle of the K doing?
Generally, the people in the middle of the K are starting to migrate down to the lower leg of the K. And that's where we are seeing that strength behind off price like a TJ Maxx, because we are seeing that middle income consumer, some of which are making upwards of six figures a year, still shopping at discount stores, still shopping at off-price stores, still trying to make that dollar stretch further, which just, I think, speaks to the weight of pressure that many of these households, even seemingly well-earning households, are feeling in this cost environment.
Okay, so if most people are in the middle of the K and the bottom of the K, how is that factoring into retailers' decisions going forward? How do they make decisions about what to do and how to keep their business thriving?
Well, I think it comes through in a couple of ways. First and foremost is geography and location. So depending on who my target consumer is, we're seeing much more concentration by those upper, higher income serving retailers into those very affluent areas. At the bottom end, we're seeing a lot of expansion by those discount, by those off-price, by those value retailers everywhere else. So as we think about openings and closures, for example, and we think about who's opening stores versus who's closing stores, the vast majority of store openings here over the last couple of years have been by the likes of Dollar General, Dollar Tree, TJ Maxx, Ross, right? These are all stores that are catering really to those consumers seeking out value, seeking out discount. So while on whole, as I mentioned, openings and closures are kind of balanced and they're meeting each other head on, the openings are very much being driven by those lower end value providing retailers.
Talk to me about real estate for a minute. Like, are retailers considering decreasing their footprint, maybe having smaller stores instead of these huge big box locations that probably cost more money?
Absolutely. So I think outside of the general merchandisers like a Target or Walmart, or the warehouse clubs like a Costco or a BJ's, everyone else is seemingly trying to get skinnier and to do more with less. And a lot of that just has to do with the cost environment. A lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of sales do now flow through e-commerce channels. So I don't need to keep as much inventory on site, on the floor. And so where I used to maybe need a 15,000 square foot store, I now can probably do a very similar level of sales out of a 10,000 square foot store. Mm-hmm. And what that's doing is just creating a much more efficient environment for retailers as they do look to expand their store counts.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what the data says about the present and the future of retail shopping with Brandon Sveck, National Director of the U.S. Retail Analytics CoStar Group. We spoke to you in 2024, and the demand for retail space was outstripping supply. Is that still the case?
It's been, I would say, more evenly distributed here over the last year. So we've seen the amount of store closures or the amount of demand losses really meeting the amount of new demand from retailers head on, and supply continues to dwindle. Obviously, because of all of these factors that we're talking about, we haven't needed a lot of new retail supply across the country. So back when we spoke in 2024, I was talking about very low levels of supply, which was allowing that demand to exceed it. Today, those levels of new supply are even lower. So demand is meeting new supply head on, but it's doing so at a much lower level of supply that's needing to be met.
Retail spaces fall into, like, you categorize them as class A, B, and C. Can you tell me what those are? What's class A, B, and C of a retail space?
Yeah, certainly. So generally, when we classify retail space, the number one most critical factor is how much sales can be generated at that property. So a lot of the classification system is really going to be based more upon the economic potential of the site, with the remainder being facade, feel, effectively how pretty is the property, how new is the property, and how well kept has the property been. And what you see is a pretty consistent correlation between those Class A properties being able to capture and attract those higher quality tenants able to pay higher rents. And the reason they're able to do that is because those sites are sitting in locations where, due to density and strong incomes, they're able to generate a higher level of sales.
Okay, so that was Class A. Is that what you said?
That's Class A, absolutely.
Okay, so B and C are smaller than that, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So when we think about Class B, that's really going to describe the vast majority of your suburban shopping centers across America, most of which were built last century, most of which are still in nice shape, not in need of repair in any way, but are really catering more to that middle income consumer. When we think about Class C, we're thinking about properties generally in areas that have struggled economically, generally in areas where the landlords have struggled to invest in those properties. And so we're thinking more dim lighting, older facade, potentially cracks or holes in the parking lot, right? It's generally, from a look and feel perspective, just not as well upkept or desirable of a shopping center.
Do you know where we're having the most success? Is it in a mall, in a downtown, or is it these like lifestyle center communities that everyone's building where like there's apartments above and the shopping below? Like, where is the most success happening?
The most success has been occurring actually out in the suburbs, in affluent suburbs of America, and traditional shopping and power centers have really where we've seen the greatest amount of success of late. I would say that's shifting, though, as we've seen consumers come back to the urban environment, as we've seen jobs come back to the urban environment and workers come back to the office. We're now starting to see greater performance in our urban downtown areas, which a lot of that product is that ground floor retail with the apartments built above that you mentioned.
You didn't mention malls, though. What about that?
malls are their own story. So I would say the picture for malls in America is highly bifurcated. There will always be a place for malls in America, but we're seeing that shift away from what I would call the commodity mall or your traditional mall built around four or five department stores and more towards your high-end luxury malls. So we've seen the bottom half of malls really struggle here over the last decade or so. These are the malls that are losing their department stores and then losing their Francescas and other inline space, or inline being the middle of the mall, along the way as the department stores go. The middle market of the mall spectrum is really kind of held flat and just kind of treaded water. But it's those luxury high-end malls that are attracting the affluent investor or the affluent consumer that still has the means to shop, is seeing their wealth grow by stock market and real estate wealth effect. And they're traditionally doing very, very well. So I would say the mall spectrum as a whole is highly bifurcated, and it's really following the same lines that the overall consumer trends are, where the affluent, the high-end malls are doing very well, and those kind of everyone else is treading water at best, or at worst, starting to close stores and potentially look down a path of redevelopment.
We only have a minute left, but we talked earlier about Value City Furniture going out of business. Also here, Big Lots, Joann's, those are all Ohio-based companies that went out of business. And these are huge storefronts. So they're like really big spaces. A furniture store takes up a lot of space. But you're saying that new ones haven't been built. So there are people out there to use these big storefronts.
There are up to a certain size. Frankly, Amy, once you get above 35 to 40,000 square feet, your tenant pool gets very, very thin. So some of these stores where we're talking 25, 30,000 square feet will easily backfill. And we're still seeing very strong demand to backfill those spaces in the right locations. But these bigger 50, 60, 70,000 square foot stores, there's just so few users. There's so few tenants who can move into that space and operate profitably that the demand pool really thins out. So when we think about a Value City Furniture, those are certainly going to be harder to backfill from a closure perspective than a Francesca's, who, while they're in a mall, it's a struggling segment. It's a much smaller, easier to digest size that I can move, you know, a greater, wider potential demand of tenants into.
We've been talking with Brandon Speck, National Director of U.S. Retail Analytics CoStar Group. Thank you so much for your time today, Brandon.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. If you missed any part of today's show or any show, be sure to listen back at WOSU.org/allsides. Subscribe to our podcast, and every episode is in the WOSU mobile app. This is 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.